What are we specially taught by these words, before me, in the first commandment? These words, before me, in the first commandment, teach us that God, who seeth all things, taketh notice of, and is much displeased with, the sin of having any other God.
You'll remember that I said that in the exposition of the Ten Commandments, the Shorter Catechism, with each commandment, tells us what the commandment is, what's required, and what's forbidden. And I said then it also will add, depending on the commandment, an extra question, and in some cases, like in the fourth commandment, several extra questions that kind of break open specific parts of the commandment. We see that here in the first commandment. So question 48 is actually asking an extra question about two words. In the commandment, we have the words, before me. And it's basically saying, why are those words put in there? What is significant? What are we being taught? What doctrine is being communicated to us through those words, before me? And it teaches us a few things. It teaches us that God sees all things. So God sees all things. Remember the words from Genesis, "Thou, God, seest me." And this is an important one, I think, for children to be thinking about. It's important for two reasons. One, it's a great comfort to us. God sees us at all times. So when we're alone, perhaps in the dark, perhaps tempted to be uncomfortable or a little fearful, being able to say, "Thou, God, seest me," can impart great comfort. The Lord is there. He sees and is present with us. It also is, so it's a comfort, it can also be convicting to us. So it's also good for children to remember, mommy and daddy can't be everywhere at all times, and they can't see everything that we're doing. They can't even see everything we're doing on the outside with our bodies. So when you're sticking your hand in the cookie jar, when mama has said no cookies before supper, mommy and daddy may not see, but God sees. God's observing your hand in the cookie jar. But there's more than that, because God not only sees our outside, he also sees our inside. So unlike any other person in the world, he can see our thoughts and knows them from afar off, the Bible says. He knows them before we even think them. He knows what's going on in our hearts. He knows more about us inside and out than we know about ourselves. So this is an important point, that God sees all things. And it brings out two attributes that you can be thinking about. Both of them begin with the word omni, or the omnipresent, right? Omni. So that's the word for all. It comes from the Latin. The word all. And so it's the first thing means that he is all knowing. He knows all things. And the second one is that he is all or everywhere present. So God knows all things, and he is everywhere, right? When you sing through Psalm 139, this comes out. The psalmist is saying, if I go all the way up into the heavens, behold, thou art there. If I go all the way down in the depths of the earth, thou art there. If I go into the depths of the sea, thou art there. In other words, the point is, there's nowhere you can go that God is not present. And there's nothing that you can think or do that God does not see. He is all-knowing and everywhere present. And so to deny the Lord equals saying, in essence, that he is not God. And that therefore, there is not a final judgment. And this is a problem. Here in the Catechism, it's saying that God, who seeth all things, taketh notice of, is much displeased with, the sin of having any other God. None of this is missed by the Lord. And he is displeased with it. There is an accounting. There is accountability. Because there is a final judgment that is coming, where the Lord will render unto everyone according to their works. Every idle word will give an account for on the last day. But it also tells us, it's bringing us back to where we started with this commandment. The Lord takes special notice of this wicked sin of idolatry. Right? We've underlined that already in terms of our study. He is especially interested in this sin of idolatry, and the Catechism says he is much displeased by it. So wherever we find it in existence, we are finding something or someone that is a rival to God. It is like a spiritual coup. So children, sometimes we'll hear in the news about, you know, a country elsewhere in the world, and there was a coup that took place. And that's there's a group of people that rose up and sought to overthrow the government by surprise. And this is what's happening spiritually. Men and women and boys and girls are engaged in a spiritual coup. They're seeking, and it will be entirely unsuccessful, but they're seeking to dethrone God, to unseat him, as it were. It is a direct attack on the honor of God to give the honor that is due to him to anyone else. And this greatly displeases the Lord, because God is concerned chiefly with his own glory. He's created the whole world for his glory. He's redeemed his people for his glory. He's carrying out all the works of history and his providence for his glory. Everything centers on the glory of God. And these forms of denying the Lord or giving the honor that's due to him to another, these forms of idolatry are a direct attack on his glory. You think, for example, of how this takes place in the Roman Catholic Church. They will encourage people to pray to Mary or to pray to other departed or dead saints, or to pray to angels, and so on. And what is this doing? Prayer is an act of worship. And so we're giving an act of worship to someone other than God himself. But not only that, we are actually giving divine attributes, things that belong to God's own glory, to other people as well. You know, we're saying in essence that Mary or one of the saints is omniscient, they're all-knowing, that they're omnipresent, that they're everywhere present. Because how can you have, you know, thousands of people all over the world, from Mongolia to Michigan and everything else in between, all of these thousands of people all over the world praying to Mary at the same time? She's just a person. She's a departed soul. She would have to be omnipresent. She would have to be omniscient. You see, this is a gross form of idolatry within the Roman Church, to pray to the saints or to angels. We can't give divine honor to anything or anyone that is not divine, that is not God himself. Now, we can take this yet another step further. Because, as I said, when we think of idolatry, maybe we think of a little statue of Buddha, or we think of, you know, the kind of wooden carved idols that you'll see in places like Africa, or, you know, ones that are cast in metal. And we think, okay, those are idols. Or you might think of all of the relics in the Roman Catholic Church and all of their religious symbols and idols and so on and so forth. And all of those things are good examples of idols. But we can also have mental or secret idols as well. I said previously, idolatry is not just what you do with your hand, but it's also what you do with your head and with your heart as well. We can have mental, secret idols. When any other object takes or captivates first place in our heart and affections, we are engaging in idolatry. If we give our hearts and affections, which belong to God, chiefly, to something else, we're engaged in idolatry. The Puritans would talk about inordinate love. So loving something in a way that you should only love God. Giving to someone or something our chief, our best, our strongest affection or love. Well, that belongs to God alone. So you'll see Paul when he's writing to the Colossians, and he'll speak of covetousness. So he's warning them against the sin of covetousness. And then he makes this parenthetical comment, covetousness, which is idolatry. So he's connecting the 10th commandment with the first commandment. Do you see that? He's saying when you're coveting something, you're not content with, you're not satisfied with what God has allotted in his wisdom and providence to you. You're wanting something that doesn't belong to you and that isn't yours, and you're wanting it very strongly. That is turning the thing into an idol, right? You're transgressing God's law, and you're turning away from the Lord and making this object the chief thing in your heart and in your life. Now, that can be money, right? The love of money leads to all kinds of evil. So it's not that money itself is inherently sinful. It's not. It can be used for the glory of God and the good of his people. But the love of money, it's turning money into an idol, as it were. That leads to all sorts of destructive influences. There are people who will turn pleasure into an idol. So having fun and doing something that excites me and finding pleasure, and it can be in all sorts of things. For different people, it may be different activities, but they idolize it and they say, this is what I live for. Right? I have to work or I have to go to school because they're necessary to enable me to do what I really want to do. The thing I'm living for is, and you can fill in the blank, this pleasure. That's a form of secret or mental idolatry. You can even take, you know, there are plenty of good things that God gives us that we can turn into idols. God gives us gifts, and rather than the gifts bringing our hearts back to the giver, to worship him and to love him and to return with gratitude to him and to use the gifts to serve him and to glorify him, we can dispose of the giver and just make the gifts themselves our object of worship or delight or idolatry. So it can be as common as something like family. I mean, God's given to us family, husbands and wives, parents and children, siblings, wonderful institution, something the Lord's given to glorify him with, where it's an arena in which we serve him. There's all sorts of wonderful things that come from that. But Jesus says, if you love your father or mother, your sister, your brother, your husband, your wife, or whatever, above me, you're not worthy of me. He's to have the chief place. And we're to actually hate those.
in comparison to the intensity of love for him. And we're to turn from those who turn from him. So husbands, wives, parents, children, siblings, and so on, these are arenas in which we ultimately serve the Lord and which we glorify and honor him. And they are ways in which our love for him is worked out. And in godly families, the families are not self-serving. You know, it's not as if our family is this wonderful thing that is the object of all of our focus, and we want to make our family great and so on. It's just a form of idolatry. The Psalms warn about those who try to turn their name, their family name, into something, and their property and so on. He says they're left in the grave. But rather, they are means of through which we can serve the Lord. So my point here is not to allow this commandment to get too far away from us, right? There's atheism is a wicked sin, various forms of idolatry, kind of physical false religion forms of idolatry need to be discarded. But we also need to bring it to the quick, down into our own hearts and search ourselves out to say, this commandment's requiring that my whole heart be given chiefly and fully to the Lord. The Lord sees what's inside me. He knows all these things, and he's displeased with the sin of making anything else, giving anything else the place that he alone deserves. So in question 48, what are we specially taught by these words before me in the first commandment? These words before me in the first commandment teach us that God, who seeth all things, taketh notice of and is much displeased with the sin of having any other God.